at npr.org.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Bush is in Monterrey, Mexico tonight, one day into a summit meeting with 34 leaders from across the Americas. There is much unease with the United States in Latin America these days. Job one for President Bush is to patch up frayed relations with Mexico's president, Vicente Fox. Life has not been easy for President Fox lately. Tonight on Point, inside Vicente Fox's Mexico. We begin in Monterrey, Mexico, where President Bush met one-on-one with President Fox today. Maura Reynolds is White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. I asked her how the meeting between the two went.
It looked like it went very, very well. Both presidents walked into their news conference in an upbeat mood, and they had nothing but nice things to say to each other.
And what did President Fox have to say about President Bush's very recent initiative on immigration reform in the U.S.?
Well, he couldn't say enough that was good about it. He came out much more forcefully than he has since the president made the announcement and endorsed it wholeheartedly without any reservations. This was a very strong endorsement by the Mexican president.
So are we back to the two amigos? What about the problems that the U.S. and Mexico have had over the war in Iraq, over Mexico's stand on that war at the U.N., and hard feelings about the immigration ball being dropped by Bush earlier?
Well, I think it would be foolish to think that there were no residual hard feelings anywhere, but they're certainly not in public at this point. I think that there are policy disagreements between the two countries that need to be worked out. But Fox went as far as he could today, even to praise the American policy in Iraq, saying it was in the interest of democracies all around the world to eradicate terrorism, and even congratulated Bush on the capture of Saddam Hussein. He did not say he approved of the decision to go to war initially, but he went as far as he could in these other areas to endorse President Bush's policies.
And President Bush reciprocated with an invitation to the Mexican president to his ranch at Crawford in March.
Yes. Well, I mean, if you recall, there was a previous invitation summit set up at the ranch in Crawford that was canceled by Vicente Fox over some other disagreements in the U.S.-Mexican relationship. That was back when things began to get very testy.
Really declined by him. He said, sorry, but I really can't come, given
exactly. And it was because the U.S. was going ahead and executing a Mexican national. So this is sort of a sign that Bush is really trying to get this relationship back to where it was 3 years ago.
Maura Reynolds, President Bush really needs Vicente Fox's friendship in this Latin American meeting, doesn't he? He's got a lot of skeptical leaders from other Latin American nations on hand.
Yes, he does. There is a sense that what the United States would like to do, although no officials will say this on the record, is develop Vicente Fox as kind of a liaison with the United States and the rest of Latin America, because Fox has very definite political and economic interests in his relationship with the United States, and he's also, you know, a very large country in Latin America and can hold a lot of sway with the other leaders. So it really seems like Bush would like him to play that role, but he's got domestic concerns of his own, and Latin America is a very complicated place with lots of different countries with different problems, and so that would not necessarily be an easy role for Fox to play.
And he may not be successful enough domestically in Mexico right now to be at his best in that role, but he's still fundamentally able to line up with George Bush on many fronts, whereas it looks as though many of these other leaders do not. Your own newspaper, the LA Times, has written about a real sense of disenchantment in Latin America with Washington over the past few years, quoted the one-time foreign minister of Mexico describing Bush's administration treating Latin America as an Atlantis, a lost continent.
Well, it's hard not to blame them. I mean, Bush came into office saying that he was really going to focus on relationships with Latin America, that it was very important in the world of foreign policy to start off with having good relations with your neighbors. And then basically that went right out the window, especially after September 11th. And Bush became completely wrapped up in events elsewhere in the world, especially in Iraq and the Middle East, and, you know, more or less ignored Latin America, although U.S. officials will deny that. But there's no getting around the fact that there was no movement, and in fact, a lot of backwards movement on issues including immigration, and that was just until very recently, until this past fall.
Your colleague Richard Boudreau writes that something like half of Latin America's people, 220 million, live in poverty, that the number of jobless has doubled in the last 10 years. Those would be the NAFTA years. That per capita income has shrunk in every country but Chile. What is President Bush holding out now, if anything, that might promise turnaround?
Well, this is a very difficult problem for the United States, because if you look back on where U.S. relations with Latin America have come since the 1980s, there's been an improvement in Latin America in that many military dictatorships have disappeared, and there's been a growth of democracy and of free trade. But in those countries, there's also been an increase in poverty, and many people here, as they did in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, have blamed democracy and liberalization of trade for many of their perceived economic woes. And this means that as Bush pushes for greater free trade, that dissatisfaction in Latin America over poverty and particularly over corruption is really rising. Bush and Fox both spoke about this today, and their answer is that you need to have the rule of law, you need to rein in corruption. They blame corruption for the fact that free trade did not provide better economic benefits for the people of Latin America, but they said that more trade is a good thing.
And now President Bush and Washington are pushing the free trade agreement of the Americas. Brazil and Venezuela don't even want to talk about it. Will it be on the agenda in Monterrey? Will it be pushed through by 2005?
Well, it will not be on the official agenda. The only way that the nations agreed to come to this special summit was with an explicit promise that trade would not be discussed because it's so contentious. However, you know, one can only imagine that it will be a matter of discussion on the sidelines among the leaders. It's not clear yet. The U.S. has made a proposal to try to push back the deadline for agreeing to a free trade agreement, the FTAA. Past 2005, there are countries that don't want to do that. It's all sort of up in the air. I think that really remains to be seen.
In the meantime, in the past few years, violent popular uprisings and one military coup have toppled elected leaders in Argentina, Bolivia, Ecuador, Paraguay, and Peru. President Bush must be happy to be standing with Vicente Fox, Mexico's man.
Yes, absolutely.
Maura Reynolds, thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Maura Reynolds is White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with me from Monterrey, Mexico. Three years ago, Presidents Vicente Fox and George W. Bush rode onto the political scene like the gentleman ranchers they were. Bush spoke Spanish and promised a new embrace of Latin America. Fox had ended Mexico's seven decades of stultifying one-party rule and promised much more reform to come. Then Bush fell into the trauma of 9/11 and Fox into the bog of Mexican political realities. Now the American president is turning back toward his Mexican friend. But Vicente Fox and perhaps Mexico are in trouble. Only halfway through his six-year term, many in Mexico are calling Mexico's big caballero a lame duck. Tonight on Point, inside Vicente Fox's Mexico, how could Mexico's big guy in cowboy boots go from hero to lame duck in 3 years? With a disillusioned Latin America drifting left, does George Bush need Mexico more now than ever? And does all the talk of U.S. immigration reform have you focused on what's going on inside Mexico? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Chapel Lawson, Associate Professor of Political Science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a former Director of Inter-American Affairs on the National Security Council. Good evening and welcome, Chapel Lawson.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you. Also joining us tonight from Puebla, Mexico, is Jose Luis Garcia Aguilar, head of the International Relations Department at the University of the Americas in Puebla, Mexico. Good evening and welcome, Professor Garcia.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
It's wonderful to have you tonight. Thank you for joining us. Chapel Lawson, take us in first to that moment 3 years ago when Vicente Fox won the presidency of Mexico. What was the meaning of that? What was the significance of that? It sounded like a thunderclap up here. It must have felt like it down there. Why? Why such a big deal?
That was a dramatic moment. Maybe not quite as sudden or spectacular as the fall of the Berlin Wall, but an era where one party had dominated the presidency of Mexico for 71 years, and the presidency itself had been an almost all-powerful institution. All of a sudden, politics in Mexico were up for grabs. A president claiming to stand for change had taken over. And on July 2nd, 2000, that candidate, Vicente Fox, won the election. It was a pretty dramatic moment, I think, for Mexicans, and many people had high hopes for the Fox administration.
And what were those expectations? At that moment, what were Mexicans hoping that Vicente Fox would deliver? And maybe not all Mexicans shared the same hopes, but the big mass who voted him in.
Certainly the 42.5% of Mexicans who voted for Fox in 2000 were voting for change. They were voting to punish the old ruling party, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, mm-hmm. by its Spanish initials. And they were not voting for a radical break with the past, but they were voting for continued political reform, for democratic deepening, for an end to corruption, and hopefully for some alleviation of poverty and generalized economic growth.
Professor Garcia, here we are, 3 years on. How does the Fox record look?
Well, in my estimation, not very good. I agree totally with Professor Lawson in the sense that the expectations were high. During 70 years, we lived in an authoritarian system, and it was a really big task for President Fox to win the presidency and to make possible for Mexico to advance to democracy. But he promised a lot during his campaign, and my idea is that, for example, he committed a lot of mistakes, saying, for example, that he would resolve the Chiapas crisis in 15 minutes, and he promised 7% growth, economic growth per year, things like that. So the expectations were high, and also after 3 years, you have the PRI there in majority in Congress. He was unable to deliver the reforms needed for bigger economic growth. And also some of the, as one of his secretaries mentioned today, is the coordinator of his party,
yes.
in Congress, in the Chamber of Deputies. He said that he will cook the big fish in fighting corruption. And I think that the big fishes are still there, swinging.
The corruption is still there. Professor Garcia, you were quoted today in the Washington Post saying that right now Fox is not really relevant. He's not even a leader in Latin America. His stature is very low. He needs Bush. And you say, my sense is that he's alone with no idea how to finish, that is, the next 3 years of his term, and he's just floating. I think he just wants to go back to his ranch and forget all this. That sounds pretty bad. Why such frustration? Why so ineffective?
Yeah, well, I think that because of the expectations were very high. And you know what? When he won the presidency, he really arrived as a big leader in Latin America. To defeat the PRI was not easy. And he embraced the expectations of a lot of Mexicans that during generations and generations were expecting the change. And right now, given that he has, in my opinion, no clear vision to where lead the country, to negotiate with the rest of the political leaders, I think he's a man of good faith, but with a lack of necessary skills to make negotiations and to reach deals with the rest of the politicians, in particular with
right.
the PRI.
Chapel Lawson, let me turn to Chapel Lawson for just a moment. It's quite
sure.
a picture. Here's this big guy, 6'6", we're told, in his cowboy boots, with a big victory, really changed the face of Mexican politics and now can't deliver. Part of this goes back to Mexican culture and deeply embedded politics. I'm sure you've written that part of it goes to the institutions that he's dealing with.
Yeah, I wish I could disagree with what Professor Garcia is saying, but I think he's got it right. Fox is in many ways a victim of democratization in some sense.
What do you mean by
for,
that?
For years, the Mexican president could get passed any law he wanted. He controlled both houses of Congress through the ruling party, and now it's a three-party system with an independently elected president. It's virtually impossible to imagine that a president will have a majority in both houses of Congress.
And his party has a majority in none.
In neither. And I think that's going to be true as far as the eye can see for any president in Mexican politics in the future. And that's a big handicap.
All that charisma in this man, and that's undeniable. He won in large part on that charisma, but there's just nowhere for it to go, nowhere for it to push.
It was remarkable for a president with 70%, 80% approval ratings right when he took office that he could get almost nothing done in the legislature because of his inability to negotiate with the opposition parties. And I should just add that this opposition was on the recalcitrant side. I mean, I would love to blame Vicente Fox or his cabinet for their inability to negotiate, But in fact,
they didn't really have an interest in reform. We're going to come back and look at that, exactly what Mexico was and is. We're talking tonight about Vicente Fox's Mexico and the Bush-Fox meeting today in Monterrey. You can join the conversation. How could Mexico's big guy in cowboy boots go from hero to lame duck in 3 years? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Vicente Fox's Mexico and the Bush-Fox meeting today in Monterrey, Mexico. You can join our conversation tonight. Has all the immigration reform talk got you focused on what's going on inside Mexico? With a disillusioned Latin America drifting left, does George Bush need Mexico, need Vicente Fox more than ever? Did you imagine that NAFTA plus Fox would give the U.S. a booming southern neighbor? Where is that boom? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight from Puebla, Mexico, Professor Jose Luis Garcia Aguilar. He's head of the International Relations Department at the University of the Americas in Puebla. And with me in the studio tonight, Chapel Lawson, Associate Professor of Political Science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Chapel Lawson, paint a picture of Mexico for us in Latin American terms. Where does it stand in terms of its economy, the success of its democracy, young as it may be now in some ways? What's the health of this country, its poverty level?
Well, it's really hard to imagine a more important country for the United States. This is a country we share almost a 2,000-mile border with. That border, you know, is protected but largely demilitarized, so it's hard to imagine us fighting wars abroad if we had to protect that border at home. We don't. It's our second largest trading partner with about $230 billion in trade a year. That's billion with a B, and billions of dollars of foreign investment. Millions of border crossings each year.
Legal and illegal.
Each day. Mm-hmm. And many of them illegal. Perhaps 7 million illegal Mexican migrants to the United States currently living in the U.S. This is a member of the OECD, the ninth largest economy in the world, and nevertheless, not very well understood by most Americans.
So take us inside Mexico. First of all, NAFTA, has it worked for Mexico or not?
This is a big source of debate. On one level, NAFTA has been enormously important in the Mexican economy by boosting exports, and exports really are the most vital, vibrant sector of the Mexican economy. On the other hand, the benefits of growth from NAFTA and general economic growth from other means really haven't trickled down to the majority of the population.
So who's hanging on to them? What's this elite class that gobbles up that profit?
So it's, from one perspective, about 40% of Mexicans live in poverty, and about 40 families control an enormous portion of Mexico's GDP. And none of this has really changed as a result of democratization.
Now, why not? You would expect it to change. Jose Luis Garcia Aguilar in Puebla. Why hasn't – I mean, of course, nobody wants to give up a privileged status that these 40 families have. But why hasn't democracy been able to batter that down a little bit, spread the wealth around?
Well, I think it's the structure of our political system. I mean, Dr. Lawson was right when he described how the political forces are right now in Mexico, and President Fox doesn't have control of Congress, and part of the things that I said to the Washington Post that were not in the printed edition was precisely that I think the political elite is also fighting President Fox because he, particularly in the PRI, they want to come back to power. So they really want to block him in any way possible. So it is the way in which the power is distributed right now in Mexico.
If the PRI comes back to power, Chapel Lawson, does that mean walking away from the democratic beachhead that Mexico's accomplished here? Does it mean backsliding, or does it simply mean a different party in power? Is it back to the bad old ways or not?
I think a little bit of both. It won't be quite as bad as it used to be. There's been a major change in Mexico, and the electoral system, I think, works very honestly, something that didn't happen before 1996, 1997. But one of the biggest problems for Fox or for anybody else who's trying to reform Mexico's political and economic system is that the PRI is the largest party in Congress, and it's very difficult to try to prosecute anybody who's associated with abuse or corruption under the old regime while you're also trying to cut deals with them in the legislature for laws to move forward.
Well, how aggressive has Vicente Fox been on that front? I mean, he doesn't come across as a barn-burning reformer. He comes across, despite throwing them out, he comes across as kind of conservative.
No, I think to the great disappointment of many Mexicans, including many early supporters of Fox, he's basically punted on this issue of dealing with Mexico's authoritarian past. And there's been only a very limited attempt to account for the abuses under the old regime, be they human rights abuses or corruption.
Are they bad enough that they might justify a kind of truth and reconciliation inquiry? Are they of that magnitude?
I think they are, and certainly many Mexicans have suggested that. Mexico, during the late 1970s and early 1980s, conducted its own dirty war that was probably on the scale of the dirty war in Brazil, not as large as that in Chile or Argentina, mm-hmm. but nevertheless significant. Mm-hmm. Something like a South African-style Truth and Reconciliation Commission might really have been appropriate for Mexico.
Professor Garcia, how about it? Is there any sign of that on the horizon, or are the entrenched powers in Mexico just so powerful that that's not going to happen?
I'm sorry, I couldn't understand your question.
Is there any sign that there might be a kind of look back into Mexico's past and an effort to bring to justice people who may have been involved either in corporate corruption or in government corruption or government misdeeds during those long years of PRI reign?
Well, I don't see any sign that President Fox really want to explore the past sins of the PRI. In fact, I think even if he wants to do that, it is impossible to do something beyond certain declarations to the press, something like that, because the PRI holds the majority in Congress. So they can blackmail the president. They did that in the past, in the last 2 years. If he wants to make some further explorations in the PRI past, some reconciliation. On the other hand, I don't see any kind of either. Why? Because for the Mexican public, that will be as a proof of weakness.
Weakness.
Mm-hmm. Weakness, mm-hmm. exactly.
So they don't want to look back. Now, Vicente Fox doesn't have another term coming. It's 6 years, but it's one term only. So there's
no re-election. Yeah.
That's right.
So the lame duck status can come pretty quickly. In the midterm elections there last summer, his party did not do well.
No, his party suffered a reversal. And I think any real progress on the human rights front or on addressing corruption or the sins of the past is going to have to wait until 2006, when it's likely that the party of the left will do very well and may, in fact, win the presidency.
Does Mexico need a look back? Does it need more reform in order to continue economic growth? Is there a connection here, Chapel Lawson?
I think what Mexico, first of all, needs is economic reform to continue economic growth, and Fox has so far been just unable to deliver it. If Mexico were able to raise its taxation rate as a percentage of GDP to the OECD average, Mexico could fund universal health care. It could fund enormous amounts of anti-poverty programs. And until it does that, until it increases its tax base, it's never going to happen.
But it's not going to do that because?
Obviously, in Mexico, like in other countries, raising taxes is not politically popular. Even if it's linked to increases in social service provision. And people are skeptical of politicians. In that context, the opposition can make great hay out of Vicente Fox's attempts to raise taxes and portray them as, you know, anti-popular measures.
We're talking tonight about Vicente Fox's Mexico and the Bush-Fox meeting in Monterrey. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Camille is calling from New Berlin, Wisconsin. Hi, Camille. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Can you hear me well enough?
Loud and clear. What's on your mind, Camille?
I wanted to mention that I don't think we ever supported democracy in Mexico or Latin American countries. All the way down to Porfirio Diaz was supported by U.S. troops. We were very much against the changeover to a democratic society in Mexico. We can cite several examples between Chile, Argentina, Nicaragua, all of these countries that had dictatorships that we supported. We were more interested in our business interests. NAFTA, its precursor, La Maquiladora, before that the Obrero program, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. was never to improve Mexico's life, but to provide businesses with cheap labor.
Camille,
I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks for your call. We'll pick it up. Chapel Lawson, you know this critique. It's widely held out there. On the other hand,
There has been democratic evolution in Latin America in the past 15 years or so, and Washington has been, at least publicly, very welcoming of it.
No, I'm sympathetic to this critique, and it was certainly true for a large portion of the Cold War era when the United States was fearful of any kind of leftist mobilization in Latin America and always preferred the more conservative dictatorship to even a democratically elected government that leaned left. I think that's not been so much the case since the end of the Cold War, and I think in Mexico, certainly the Clinton administration was very aggressive about promoting democratization, as was the first administration of the first President Bush. Lately, I think U.S. policy has been moving a little bit away from democracy promotion in the region, and that's a really sad fact.
And why would that be? Because there's unrest again? They're afraid of the region again, of popular sentiment?
I think it's as much as anything myopia and sort of lack of initiative. I guess there's two visions of the way the United States should engage with Latin America. One was the vision of Woodrow Wilson that we're best served by a hemisphere of free-trading liberal democracies. Uh-huh. And I think that was the policy of the first Bush administration and the Clinton administration after it. There's a more unilateralist, I think, vision that dominates now, which emphasizes the United States' willingness to kind of capriciously intervene in favor of short-term interests in the region. And we've seen a lot more of that in recent years. We saw some toward the end of the Clinton administration as well. But the United States is enormously powerful in the region, and it's unlikely to be constrained by an organization like the OAS or mm-hmm. the UN.
There's been resistance today. Bush's administration is pushing for this Summit of the Americas and perhaps by extension the OAS to boot out countries who are seen to have corrupt leadership. That's been quite controversial. Most of Latin America, or much of it, is pushed back. Jose Luis Garcia Aguilar, why is that not accepted as an idea among Latin American leaders?
Well, you know, corruption is deeply rooted in the political process. So, let me take the case of Mexico. During a lot of years, the politicians used the term sovereignty just to cover their responsibility in, for example, human rights abuses, mm-hmm. in corruption, things like that. So the idea to defend sovereignty, for example, was also to cover their sins. So I think it is in certain ways, the same in the rest of Latin America.
And what about
because if you add certain populistic rhetoric, which includes a very nationalistic element, so you have there a very defensive position.
And what about Chapel Lawson's observation that the U.S. may have tilted away from supporting democracy? I mean, it's tilted away for many decades, but more recently might have favored it. Do you sense the George W. Bush administration, in this administration, a diminishing enthusiasm for democratic reform in Mexico?
Well, in particular in Mexico, probably, but I don't see that. I mean, from my perspective, as a foreign observer, mm-hmm. President Bush probably shares some Wilsonian idea of spread democracy. In the case of Mexico, you know, the position of the United States, the traditional position of the United States, has been that the United States prefers security over democracy. But right now, the transition to democracy of Mexico, I think, is irreversible. We have folks learning, all the Mexican society is learning, and it is a difficult process. We have a lot of issues here to solve, but over time, I think, I am very optimistic on this, we will solve it. I think democracy really is not a priority in the relation between Mexico and the United States.
Lee is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Lee. You're on the air.
Hi. I just heard a comment being made about how the United States is supporting democratically elected governments. And how does that square with what we were trying to do in Venezuela?
Well, I think we heard both just now, but maybe since the Cold War, a more supportive position. But what example are you pulling to mind, Lee?
I'm talking about Venezuela, where mm-hmm. we helped them the military do a coup against an elected government, and then right now we're bugging the Chavez government. They're bugging Chavez now to have a referendum before his term's up. You know, it's like California all over again.
I mean, certainly, Chepa Lawson, the United States has been a whole lot more comfortable with Vicente Fox than with President Chavez in Venezuela.
Certainly, and I think that the what happened in Venezuela was a great example of the United States moving a little bit away from its rhetoric of democratization and, in fact, supporting a coup against a democratically elected politician who we didn't like. Now, Chavez's democratic credentials are highly suspect, but I think certainly more democratic than a military coup would have been. More broadly, though, you mentioned something at the beginning of the program that I thought was really important, that Latin America is somehow drifting to the left. And I think in some ways that's certainly true, and it might also be a good thing, that the United States has been kind of peddling a vision of the world in Latin America, that it's a world of democracy and it's also a world of economic reform. I think most people in Latin America are very committed to the idea of democratization, but I think they're much more ambivalent about reforms on the economic side, very skeptical of further economic liberalization, and especially of privatizing state-owned enterprises, which is associated with massive corruption. And that's the source, I think, of a lot of the backlash to American policies in the region now.
So, Professor Garcia, what about in Mexico's case? Is there a commitment to further economic reform, or is there popular sentiment now that leads to lining the pockets of the rich and doesn't the product, the benefit of it, doesn't get shared widely enough?
Well, I think the latter is true. I mean, it's the perception that the past reforms, including the North American Free Trade Agreement, are not enough. You know what? My idea is that we have a problem with the quality of democracy, with having efficient governments that are able to deliver. And I think if when you see the polls, for example, from Latino Barometro, you can see, for example, in that all over Latin America, most of the people agree on democracy, that it is the best way of government. But asking about the efficiency of government, they are not sure about that democracy works. Same is with trust. They in Latin America, at least all across the subcontinent, the people seems to trust more the church, the army, and not the politicians, the police, and other institutions.
And so, Washington is saying today, if I may, Chapa Lawson, that corruption is the reason that people haven't achieved the full benefit of freer trade. What you're saying is many Latin Americans, perhaps Mexicans, say, yes, but corruption comes along with democracy, or democracy hasn't been able to push it back?
I think that corruption is certainly a drag to economic growth, but there's a deeper answer, and that's that free trade, deregulation, economic reform, these are half the solutions. The sorts of economic measures proposed by the IMF, by the World Bank, by the Bush administration don't go far enough, and what's needed to supplement them is real investment in poverty alleviation, in human capital formation, in basic health care, and basic education. That's what's needed in Latin America, just as much as economic reform is needed, just as much as controls about corruption are needed.
We'll come back and look at what of that, if anything, is going on in Mexico right now. We're looking tonight at Vicente Fox's Mexico and the Bush-Fox meeting in Monterrey. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Pop quiz. Which North American country has more corporate scandal and income inequality, the United States or Mexico? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Vicente Fox's Mexico and the Bush-Fox meeting in Monterrey, Mexico today. You can join the conversation. What does Mexico need to really take off democratically and economically? What might Vicente Fox have accomplished? What does he still have the capacity to accomplish? We're at 1-800-423-8255. My guest tonight, Chapa Lawson. He served as director of the Inter-American Affairs, committee section of the National Security Council. He's now associate professor of political science at MIT. And joining us from Pueblo, Mexico tonight, Jose Luis Garcia Aguilar, head of international relations at the University of Americas in Pueblo, Mexico. You can join the conversation as well, 1-800-423-8255. Kevin is calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi. I should reveal everything about me. I'm an economist at the Global Development and Environment Institute at Tufts University.
Okay.
I have a question that implies a comment. I think the one way to get the U.S.-Mexico relationship back on track and to get the economy in Mexico getting back on track so it can benefit both parties is to adopt a more European style of economic integration.
And what would that mean?
If you look at the Europeans, when they established the European Union, they realized that you needed to create a level playing field between trading partners.
We thought that's what NAFTA was, Kevin.
Well, when you have equal rules for unequal partners, you have unequal rules. That's what a Nobel Prize winner, Amartya Sen, has said. And yes, there's equal rules for NAFTA, but because Mexico is a developing country and its GDP per capita is six times less than the United States, having equal rules has skewed the process.
So what does that mean about how Europe deals with, I mean, what's the example, Europe and Turkey or Europe and Romania? What does Europe do differently that the U.S. might do with Mexico?
One of the key things in the establishment of the European Union, and I should say this is not my original idea. It was first came by Sarah Anderson in the World Policy Journal, and it's been echoed in the Foreign Affairs magazine by Robert Pastor this week. But one of the key things that that the Europeans did was they put a lot of money into infrastructure, development, environmental protection, and poverty alleviation in countries like Portugal, Spain, and Greece to be able to create more of a level playing field so that there's more equal trading.
Let us pick that up, Kevin. Thanks for your call. Chapel Lawson, Mexico is a big country with a lot of people. The U.S. has a big deficit. Can you see the United States with its own famously crumbling infrastructure building elementary schools and bridges in Mexico?
Yeah, wouldn't that be great? It's really hard to imagine that kind of thing flying in the U.S. Congress, especially the current U.S. Congress. I have to just make one addition to those comments that I think many in Mexico would argue that they don't even have equal rules under NAFTA. The most popular political mantra in Mexico during the 2006 elections may well be that NAFTA is not a good enough deal for Mexico and needs to be radically reformed. I don't think that's going to happen, but I do think that reflects a lot of sentiment on the ground in Mexico that somehow NAFTA hasn't benefited the average person nearly enough.
Let's look at what Fox wanted to do that he hasn't been able to accomplish, that he's the fronts on which he's been stymied, Chapel Lawson. What were there initiatives with which he tried to address, for example, corruption? What were his major initiatives that haven't flown?
A whole series of things. I think actually the most spectacular was something called fiscal reform, which is effectively an attempted tax increase. And that failed not once but twice. It failed in the first Congress, and it's failed again more recently. Fox appointed a special prosecutor to deal with the crimes of the old regime. But in Mexico, appointing a special prosecutor is kind of like appointing a blue ribbon commission in the United States. In other words, when you don't really want something done, you appoint a special prosecutor.
And down the rabbit hole
it
goes.
So one hasn't seen much progress on that dimension, and I wouldn't expect to see much more.
And Professor Garcia, what about Mexico's famous corruption? How does it actually work? How high in Mexico's economy and government does it still sit? How widespread is it today?
Well, I'm afraid to say that it's deeply embedded in our culture, and it's part of the practice. You know, one of the ideas I have regarding corruption is that law oftentimes is incredibly complex. So just to comply with the law, it requires a lot of requirements, and it is better and easier just to have some shortcuts to bribe people. Bribing people. So it is part of the system. And just to cut corruption, it really requires to make changes in the culture of institutions and political processes and the way in which every Mexican does his daily life.
So, Chapel Lawson, in concrete terms, what does this mean? Is everybody paying somebody something for transactions, or is this, very high-level, big-money corruption?
We've talked a lot about what's wrong in Mexico, and I think we should just mention one of the things that's right. I think especially with Fox's victory, but maybe even before Fox, under Ernesto Zedillo, gone is the sense that at the top there's just tremendous rottenness. I think people have confidence that Fox himself is an honest man, that his administration is running effectively an honest administration with a minimal level of corruption at the top, and that eventually that lack of corruption at the top will influence the behavior of subordinates.
And given history, that's a big step forward.
That's a big step forward, but it's something that's going to be long-term, if not generational. I mean, for years, Mexico's police, which is probably the most famously corrupt institution in Mexico, operated under something akin to the Roman tax collector system, in which lower echelons were almost obliged to take bribes or to solicit bribes to pay off their superiors further up the hierarchy. And that kind of embedded corruption, just like Professor Garcia said, is going to take an enormous amount of effort to reform.
Jonathan's calling from Boston. Hi, Jonathan. You're on the air.
Hello.
Good evening.
Hi. Hi. I was calling, actually, the professor from Tufts had some great points about Vincent Fox's reforms and whatnot, and he is very, his whole government, there's a lot of minimal corruption at the top, but as we work our way down, the corruption is ever increasing. Now, that's the first problem. To weed out corruption will help spell for much greater economic reform. Also, Mr. Bush's new immigration plan.
Yes.
This will this could really bring a whole new era into Mexican economic reform. I mean, now that workers can come from Mexico and get work passes in the United States, the money that is going to be entered into their economy is going to be astounding.
Well, there's been a lot of money there already, but let's look at this new program, Jonathan. Thanks for your call. Chapel Lawson, how about it? If something like what President Bush has proposed goes through, this kind of guest worker program, how big a deal for Mexico?
First of all, I'm not completely convinced yet that it will go through.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of assumptions both sides of the border that this program is going to be passed more or less as Bush proposed it, and we'll elaborate on it at the State of the Union on
but
the
20th. A lot of skepticism that it may be largely political grandstanding. But imagine for a moment that it might.
That if it goes through, I think even then, I wouldn't get my hopes up. The proposal here is essentially a three-year stay of execution for undocumented workers with a possibility of renewing for another 3 years. And at the end of that time, workers could theoretically apply for green cards for nationalization. And in between now and when they apply for naturalization, they could travel freely. That traveling freely would be an enormous benefit. But the question is, what's the payoff at the end of the 6 years? How many of these immigrants, say 8 million undocumented workers in the United States, 10 million undocumented workers in the United States, would actually be able to go through the process of nationalization? Well, the proposal of the Bush administration is for about 140,000 green cards per year. So one could imagine that the great majority of these undocumented workers would ultimately have to go back home.
Would it change the cash flow to Mexico? Or would it be more or less as it is now?
No, I don't think it will substantially increase the cash flow to Mexico. The Mexicans remit billions of dollars a year to Mexico, and that's an important source of foreign exchange, and I think it's especially important in certain rural sending communities, many of which are just ghost towns. Almost all the men have moved to the United States in search of work and send money back to their friends and families. And that cash flow process is happening. It'll be expedited. It'll be facilitated by a guest worker program, but it's not going to be tremendously enhanced.
Professor Garcia, we've just got a minute or so left. What sort of legacy is Vicente Fox building there? How do you expect he's eventually going to be seen in Mexico history? He came in with a big splash. He has not accomplished anything like his full agenda. How are Mexicans looking at him? How do you think they will down the road?
Well, I think two things. The first is that he was able to defeat the PRI and to oust that party from the presidency, which is the main important element in the Mexican political system. I think that's the main thing to make possible for other party to come to the presidency in Mexico. The second is to bring some kind of hope in that honesty is possible in the Mexican presidency. But, you know, in my estimation, in my idea, is that you only focus on Fox and the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
We still have to reform the states in the regions. For example, my state, Puebla, needs a deep political reform.
And once you get to that level, the work may never end. But at the same time, I can't help but hear that hopeful note that you're carrying tonight. We're out of time, but we appreciate so much your joining us tonight. Jose Luis Garcia Aguilar, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you to you.
And Chapel Lawson here in the studio, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Chapel Lawson, Associate Professor of Political Science at MIT, and Jose Luis Garcia Aguilar, Head of International Relations at the University of the Americas in Puebla, Mexico. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, following one Mexican family on the migrant trail, this is On Point. There are an estimated 7 million or more Mexican migrants working in the United States. Many travel back and forth over a dangerous border to labor at meatpacking plants, tomato farms, and fruit orchards in the American West and Midwest. In 1996, the Chavez family of Michoacan, Mexico, lost three of its clan who were on their way to work in the strawberry fields of California. The overloaded van they were riding in crashed while fleeing a Border Patrol vehicle. Writer Ruben Martinez followed the Chavez family for 5 years. His book, Crossing Over, A Mexican Family on the Migrant Trail, chronicles their frequent passages to follow work, which in this excerpt brought them to St. Louis, Missouri.
The day before I leave St. Louis, the Chavez family offers to show me the sights. The temperature is near zero. There are 2 feet of snow on the ground, and the roads are icy. It's a Sunday, and most of St. Louis is huddled behind frosted window panes, but we all put on our layers of shirts and sweaters and jackets and pile into a grand am with the Virgin of Guadalupe beaming down on us from the ceiling. Mexican pride being what it is, our first stop is a Mexican store that offers the usual assortment of old-world spices and meat cuts, tortillas and salsas, Mexican B-movies on video, and votive candles emblazoned with the saints to whom many a migrant prayer is whispered. We are received with great gusto by the owners, clerks, and customers, all intent on showing off the Mexico they brought with them to this icy outpost of the American Midwest. La tradición, cultural tradition that has foiled assimilation and the melting pot. And I'm demonstrating how the joke is on the gringos, even as the sons and daughters of these first-generation migrants are beginning to enunciate the consonants and vowels of an English-language future. Even as the kids are listening to hip-hop and oldies and wearing uniforms of American urban warriors, culturally communing with the African-Americans who are so misunderstood and despised by the elders of Michoacán. In the end, the joke will be on both the gringo and the Mexican guardians of reified notions of culture. The kids will be neither Mexican nor gringo, but both. And more than both, they will be the new Americans, imbibing cultures from all over the globe. No trip to St. Louis would be complete without a proper visit to the Gateway Arch, and after navigating the deserted streets of downtown, we're standing near the riverside, gazing up at the mammoth gleaming thing, a marvel of engineering, a 20th century monument to 19th century idealism. When the pioneers arrived in St. Louis and gazed westward across the river, there was nothing but prairie on the other side, cut by rutted wagon roads promising another coast, another world. There were still more than 1,000 miles to go through hostile Indian territories, through the severity of the desert, but it was God's plan that Americans cross that river, make the great expanse theirs however they could, and of course they did. For most of the year, there's a vast meadow of prairie grass beneath the arch, but in the dead of winter, an endless carpet of fresh powdery snow is unmarked by even a single footprint. We are the only tourists to brave the storm. The stark, minimal tableau inspires a photographer friend who has come along for the ride to compose a picture. The family, Baltasar, Wensi, Rosa, and Jenny in her mother's arms, are to walk out into the field of snow toward the arch. They are all stamping their feet and puffing misty breath, and Baltasar especially doesn't look thrilled by the bizarre idea. But I'm a guest, and Mexican hospitality is as famous as the American South's. So soon they are trudging through the knee-deep drifts. 25 feet out, they turn around to pose, but we wave them on. 50 feet, 100. Each time we ask them to go further, farther out, a football field away now. They are dark specks, lost in the white immensity. Their future's a gamble, an enormous risk for ideals and realities shaped by hundreds of years of exploitation and opportunity, of migrant suffering and migrant triumph. Theirs is the great rite of passage. There's the symbols of America, and yet for most of America, they are invisible, pinpoints of brown on a field of white.
Ruben Martinez, author of the forthcoming book, The New Americans. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is...